We'll get started with a quick prayer. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Heavenly Father, we place ourselves consciously in your presence. We give you thanks for the gift of this moment, to step out of our day-to-day busyness, and to go a little deeper into our understanding of our faith, of the dynamics of sin in our lives, and of how we can be freed of this sin to experience the fullness of life that you promise. We ask you to help us to approach this conversation with a light heart and an openness to receiving your word through Christ our Lord. Amen. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. So, welcome to our first installment of this Lenten series on the seven deadly sins. Many, if not all of you, I've met already, some more officially and more in depth than others, Father Justin Blanc. And this is something that I've enjoyed doing in my young priesthood, getting close to 3 years. But in a couple other parishes, I've had a good time offering courses, usually on biblical themes. That's what my specialization was in, biblical theology. So in the Eastern Panhandle and a couple of parishes, I did a course on the Psalms, and then one on the art of biblical narrative, looking at the David story through the books of Samuel. So it's something that I hope to be able to do somewhat regularly here at St. John also, to offer some opportunities for us to come together and put our faith into dialogue with Scripture, with different elements of the tradition. And I thought, since we're just starting up Lent, and the seven deadly sins is, excuse the expression, sort of a sexy topic that always piques our interest, it would be a good way to start the series by going a little deeper into these seven deadly sins. This isn't a course that I've done before. It isn't a topic that I've deepened before this, so I'm curious also to present some reflections that are well rooted in the tradition of the church, and then also to hear your comments, your experience. Maybe especially since this is spring break and our students aren't with us, I'm well aware that I have less experience in life and in the Christian life than most, if not all of you. So while I'm trying to put in the work to present some good content from the tradition of the church, I'm very much aware that there's a lot of content sitting out here that can help us to understand how these dynamics of sin and grace work in our lives. So, yesterday's gospel was a very convenient lead-in to our topic. Remember, it's Jesus being tempted in the desert, Jesus undergoing temptations. So we start with just a quote from Origen. He said, "All the temptations that we undergo, the Lord underwent them in his own flesh. He was tempted so that we might be victorious, thanks to his victory." It's a pretty basic Christian theology there, but something that we had highlighted yesterday in that gospel, and something that's important for us to remember, that all of our temptations, our spiritual battle, if you will, is something that we don't carry out alone, something that Jesus intentionally wanted to undergo so that he could show us the way forward. Now, St. Augustine, in terms of setting the stage, he simplifies sin into three categories. He says, "Every human greed is caused by the voraciousness of the flesh, the claim of the eyes, or worldly ambition." Now, we'll unpack and elaborate on those as we go forward. But it's important also, in terms of setting the stage for understanding these particular capital vices or deadly sins, to start with a brief introduction on sin itself. Certainly not the last word, the definitive word on sin, but trying to get at those deep motivations that push us to sin in our lives. One author from whom I'll be drawing a lot during these meetings, Enzo Bianchi, who's the founder of a monastic order in Italy, with whom I became friends in recent years. He points out that while temptations come to us from the outside, and those can differ depending on our state of life, our age, our culture, there are common interior elements that tend to lead us to sin. Something deeper in the interior of each of us. This can be described as a selfish tendency, a sinful inclination. In the old language, you might call it concupiscence. So this inclination to sin. And we could think of this in the sense that we're not starting off perfectly in the middle, between good and bad. We're not on the 50-yard line when we decide which way to go, but there's already something in us that's tending towards selfishness, that's tending towards sin. Something that opposes the gift of God. The New Testament defines this opposing force with the term flesh, sarx in Greek. So it defines that opposing force to God is flesh. That's important that we understand it's not a condemnation of flesh as such. Jesus took on our flesh, redeemed us. God created the world, loves the world. Our bodies aren't bad. So when we talk about flesh in a negative sense, it's in the sense that it opposes the gift of God. The Christian tradition has spoken in terms of self-love as one of these interior dynamics. And not the good, healthy self-love where we take care of ourselves, but that desire that pursues my self-interest at all costs, even without others or against others. An exclusive preoccupation with myself and my own interests that leads me to consider my own ego to be the measure of reality for others. And we can think of this as sort of the vain and spoiled brat for whom everything is permitted, and the entire world and all things and people in it have been created for my own use, my own fun. In a word, all that which opposes the profound desire of God for communion between himself and humanity and communion amongst men and women. It's that force within us that tends to turn us in on ourselves, to make us selfish, make us think that others and other things are there for my use, for my self-affirmation. It's part of that self-love that the Christian tradition has identified as being at the root of sin. Then we can go one step deeper and ask, well, where does this harmful self-love come from? And one answer is suggested to us in the book of Hebrews, a letter to the Hebrews. So Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14 and 15. A brief line, but very insightful when we're talking about the roots of our sin. So verse 14, "Now since the children share in blood and flesh, he likewise shared in them." Jesus shared in our blood and flesh. We're good so far. "That through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who, through fear of death, have been subject to slavery all their life." So part of Jesus' project is to free those who, through fear of death, have been subject to slavery all their life. Dense, but when we unpack it, there's a fear of death that's at the root of a lot of our sin that motivates us towards selfishness, that ultimately enslaves us because of this fear. It's been suggested that throughout our entire lives we suffer from fear of death. It's enslaving death, which the book of Job calls the king of fears, because it's the root of all other fears. Now, we're not talking about death just as a biological moment, the end of our biological lives. Say, for depending on our age, our health, some of us may feel very far from fearing death as something proximate. Others may fear it more urgently. But that death, which is the root, the king of all fears, and an instigation to sin, is a force that is constantly at work in our daily life. It manifests itself as suffering, sickness, separation, rupture, the end of that which has, for me, been a vital period of my life, to the point of causing in us and around us situations of non-life, even though biologically we go on living. So to understand how that fear of death even insinuates itself in the different moments of our daily lives. And the book of Romans calls death the salary of sin, you know, something that we get from sin. But it's also an instigation to sin, that fear of death that pushes us to search for life in sin. So in brief, moved by the fear of death, man wants to preserve by any means necessary his life. He wants to possess for himself the goods of the earth. He wants to dominate others. In this way, he thinks he is able to secure for himself an abundant life, to be able to combat death by self-affirmation. And he even begins to consider reasonable and just any behavior that is finalized to this end, even if it means harming others or even himself. In this way, we end up traipsing the path of death. And we can think of this in terms of that seemingly simple story of the Garden of Eden. That reaching for life, reaching for vitality, because we somehow believe that God won't give that to me. And so we need to affirm ourselves in order to reach for that life. So this idea of fear of death, we examine our own lives and think, well, what are those situations in which I found myself maybe not fearing death as the end of my biological life, but not feeling like I'm in a situation of vitality. Maybe a downcast period. A period where I feel like I'm drowning. And so we have that desire for life. We want to reach for it. And that's good, that desire for life. But then the problem comes in when we're vulnerable to temptation in those moments. Because we fear losing out on that vitality, losing out on life. And so man is extremely vulnerable to the temptations that falsely promise life. That love of self leads man to death, to a lack of freedom, to become prey to that which seduces and ultimately alienates him. And so the spiritual fight, looking at these deadly sins, aims to restore men and women to their own freedom, the freedom of the sons and daughters of God, to whom the gospel calls out as the path of the fullness of life. So in contrast to that fear that enslaves us, that fear of death that enslaves us, that we hear about in the letter to the Romans, our spiritual life, our spiritual warfare, spiritual grappling, aims to free us from this. And that's why, you know, the title of this series is awfully ambitious, I know. Learning the art of life by exposing the seven deadly sins. But part of the reason for that title is to make it clear that when we're looking at the seven deadly sins, it's not to be sad and to be self-accusatory and to whip ourselves and feel bad about ourselves because we fall to these things. But rather to expose them for what they are. To understand not everything about them, but some of the dynamics that are maybe working without our realizing it in our spiritual lives. And thereby freeing ourselves. Not because we'll never sin again, but perhaps we won't be enslaved to sin. Now, if you looked at the list of the seven deadly sins as they're laid out, you may realize, well, it seems like something's missing. There's one there that I've never heard about. So we look at the history of the seven deadly sins, just briefly. The origin of them comes from a 4th century monk named Evagrius Ponticus. And he first wrote about them as the eight evil thoughts. Now these originally were gluttony, fornication, avarice, pride, sadness, which, as we'll see later, also includes envy, sadness when someone else has something that I don't. Wrath, boasting, and acedia, or sloth. So these are the originals. We have this monk in the 300s, and this is a time in the church when monasticism was just starting out. And you have these people who are taking their Christian faith very seriously, and they feel this call to go deeper in the interior life. And so we have these early pioneers, if you will, of the interior life, who spend a lot of time grappling with temptation and putting a name to these things. And those names have been proven resilient across the centuries. But they were soon, after Evagrius Ponticus, they were translated into Latin by John Cassian, thus becoming part of our Western tradition as well. Then in 590, Pope Gregory I revised the list to make the more common list. So he combined sadness and acedia, vainglory and pride, and added envy. So the list that I'm using for our approach is the one from John Cassian in the middle, but it really touches on all of them. It's a matter of how you categorize them. And it's interesting to note also that even people outside of the Christian tradition have remained fascinated with these deadly sins or capital vices. In certain psychological circles, they're still being studied as just realities of part of the human psyche, realities of part of human life, that these dynamics exist within the human person and often lead to a deformation of our human life. There was a documentary series on Showtime a few years ago. I haven't seen them, but I saw that they're out there on the seven deadly sins that apparently takes real-life examples from American culture and shows how when these sins snowball, it's disastrous to human life. Now, since it's a Showtime series, it's probably not something you would watch with your kids or grandkids at home, but it gets the point across that it's still very present in our culture. And so it's good for us Christians to try to have a mature understanding, a Christian understanding, of these seven deadly sins. Because whether or not we are assailed by these temptations is not up to us. Most likely, now and then, we undergo certain temptations that can be part of these categories. And that's really not up to us. But whether or not we give in to them, whether or not we allow them to enslave us, we do have something to say about that. Father Paul Wharton, who was just here about 10 days ago to give the Thursday night Mountaineer Catholic address, made an interesting comment. He said he's been a priest for 35 years, and as a priest, as a confessor, he observes that pretty much everybody in their life has one or two of the deadly sins that they habitually struggle with, and that he hears confessed repeatedly. So these are those sentiments and impulses that sprout up in the heart, in the imagination, and they suggest to us to fall into sin. But of course, in that moment, making it seem like it's a life-giving path. Gregory the Great, in his moral comment on Job, said that it's no use going out to fight the enemies that are outside if we haven't first conquered those enemies that are within. And so we take up this battle of the interior life, not to close ourselves off from the world, as I said, not to feel bad about ourselves or to get down about sin, but rather to relate freely and joyfully with the world. And that's why also each one of these little meetings is defined as a certain sin that results in a deformed relationship with something. So our attempt to expose these sins is an attempt to help make lively our relationship with life, with the good things of life. And we begin with gluttony. Gluttony, Evagrius, that first monk who wrote about the East, called it in Greek gastrimargia, which is folly of the belly, or delirium of the belly. St. Basil called it the mother of all passions. And this is an interesting aspect of studying these sins as well, as you see how they're all interrelated. And you have some people who will say, well, gluttony is the mother of all, from there descend others. Others, well, pride is the mother of all. And some will say, well, greed. And so we look at these from different angles. The Bible is full of examples of gluttony, of how a deformed relationship with food leads to sin, leads to difficulty. Adam and Eve, who of course know that the food in question in the garden, that fruit. Noah, who experienced the inebriating effects of wine to the point of showing his nakedness to his sons. Lot, who gets drunk and has incestuous relations with his daughters. These are some of the readings that don't show up in the Sunday lectionary, but a lot of juicy content to Genesis. Esau, who concedes the right of the firstborn to Jacob for a plate of lentils. Israel in the desert, who wants to return to the slavery of Egypt, where they used to eat well at least. Now, it's important to make clear that gluttony is not a condemnation of eating well, of enjoying food, of taking pleasure in eating. On the contrary, the capacity to appreciate good quality food is to be exalted as an expression of joy and thanksgiving of the fruits of creation that are transformed by that refined form of culture and that language of love that is the kitchen. You know, that preparing a meal for someone is, in a certain sense, to say, I love you. I want you to survive. I want you to be well, to be healthy. The love that's expressed through the kitchen is extraordinary. And so as we study gluttony, let it not be something that makes us back away from appreciating the beauty of creation and the way that that becomes refined in good cooking. There's a great film. I hear it's great. I shouldn't talk about it because I haven't seen it, but I like the message that I've heard. Babette's Feast. Maybe some of you know it. And that basically, a French Catholic woman moves up to a Protestant town in Denmark, I think, and she ends up cooking this beautiful meal, but the very austere, conservative Protestants are scandalized because, you know, they're used to this very bare-bones kitchen. And, you know, through the course of the film, it comes out that, of course, her exaggerating and cooking this beautiful meal is an expression of love and relationship with others and creation. So maybe that would be a good film to watch and discuss sometime. But just as a footnote there, Babette's Feast. Just to make it clear that we're not Puritans here as we talk about gluttony. But gluttony, when appreciating food turns into gluttony, it's an attitude of immoderation and voracity, an unchecked and disordered craving, a self-satisfaction through food of the solitary ego. Now, excess is not only quantitative, but it's also qualitative. And from the very beginning of the reflections on gluttony, even the Greek fathers had two different words, gastrimargia and laimargia. Now, it's not important that we know those words, but it's curious to note that already they made a distinction between the gluttony of eating too much and the gluttony of demanding too fine of a product. So quantity, quality, and also a question of not respecting the proper times, certain rhythms of eating. Now, to understand how quality can enter into play with gluttony, I'm going to take a brief interlude and read a passage from C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters, which I imagine many of you know. it's an incredibly insightful work where Lewis takes on the persona of a tempter, you know, one of the devil's cohorts, and he's writing letters of counsel to his nephew, teaching him how to tempt humans better, how to lead them away from God, and ultimately win their souls for the devil. So Lewis, in his very imaginative way, helps us to enter into that reality of temptation. So I just want to read what Uncle Screwtape, this tempter, writes to his nephew Wormwood when he's trying to teach him how to tempt us humans through gluttony. "My dear Wormwood, the contemptuous way in which you spoke of gluttony as a means of catching souls in your last letter only shows your ignorance. One of the great achievements of the last 100 years has been to deaden the human conscience on that subject, so that by now you will hardly find a sermon preached or a conscience troubled about it in the whole length and breadth of Europe. This has largely been effected by concentrating all our efforts on gluttony of delicacy, not gluttony of excess. Your patient's mother, as I learned from the dossier, and you might have learned from Glubos, is a good example. She would be astonished, one day I hope will be, to learn that her whole life is enslaved to this kind of sensuality, which is quite concealed from her by the fact that the quantities involved are small. But what do quantities matter, provided we can use a human belly and palate to produce querulousness, impatience, uncharitableness, and self-concern? Glubos has this old woman well in hand. She is a positive terror to hostesses and servants. She's always turning from what has been offered her to say with a demure little sigh and a smile, 'Oh, please, please, all I want is a cup of tea, weak but not too weak, and the teeniest, weeniest bit of really crisp toast.' You see, because what she wants is smaller and less costly than what has been set before her, she never recognizes as gluttony her determination to get what she wants, however troublesome it may be to others. At the very moment of indulging her appetite, she believes that she is practicing temperance. In a crowded restaurant, she gives a little scream at the plate which some overworked waitress has set before her and says, 'Oh, that's far, far too much. Take it away and bring me about a quarter of it.' If challenged, she would say she was doing this to avoid waste. In reality, she does it because the particular shade of delicacy to which we have enslaved her is offended by the sight of more food than she happens to want. The real value of the quiet, unobtrusive work, which Glubos has been doing for years on this old woman, can be gauged by the way in which her belly now dominates her whole life. The woman is in what may be called the all-I-want state of mind. All she wants is a cup of tea properly made, or an egg properly boiled, or a slice of bread properly toasted. But she never finds any servant or any friend who can do these simple things properly, because her properly conceals an insatiable demand for the exact and almost impossible palatal pleasures which she imagines she remembers from the past, a past described by her as the days when you could get good servants, but known to us as the days when her senses were more easily pleased and she had pleasures of other kinds which made her less dependent on those of the table. Meanwhile, the daily disappointment produces daily ill temper. Cooks give notice and friendships are cooled. If ever the enemy, the enemy is God for the tempter, if ever the enemy introduces into her mind a faint suspicion that she is too interested in food, Glubos counters it by suggesting to her that she doesn't mind what she eats herself, but does like to have things nice for her boy. In fact, of course, her greed has been one of the chief sources of his domestic discomfort for many years. Now your patient is his mother's son. While working your hardest, quite rightly, on other fronts, you must not neglect a little quiet infiltration in respect of gluttony. Being a male, he is not so likely to be caught by the all-I-want camouflage. Males are best turned into gluttons with the help of their vanity." Did you know that? "They ought to be made to think themselves very knowing about food, to pique themselves on having found the only restaurant in the town where steaks are really properly cooked. what begins as vanity can then be gradually turned into habit. But however you approach it, the great thing is to bring him into the state in which the denial of any one indulgence, it matters not which, champagne or tea or Sol Colbert or cigarettes, puts him out, for then his charity, justice, and obedience are all at your mercy. Mere excess in food is much less valuable than delicacy. Its chief use is as a kind of artillery preparation for attacks on chastity. To be continued on the connection between gluttony and chastity. But Lewis helps us to enter into the mind of an imagined, but imaginable tempter that works on those senses of subtle suggestion that lead us to less charitable, less just states of mind because our belly is directing us in a certain way. So we know that eating is an essential function, but it's at risk of being reduced, on the one hand, to this overly fine gluttonous habit, and on the other hand, to an animalistic reflex without reason. Gluttony has been defined a vice of consumption, or consumer attitude. We give little importance to gluttony today, as we heard Lewis point out. Yet now more than ever, we experience how damaging it is to our health. It's ironic that we're more willing to accept the discomfort that comes from abuses in our relationship with food than those discomforts that come with its right and moderate use. That is, the moderate renunciations and a proper relationship with food that would allow us to have a healthy relationship with our bodies. So we're more willing often to accept the discomfort that comes after overeating or even long-term health problems, rather than putting up with that discomfort of a little self-denial that keeps us in a healthier state. It's also ironic that society, which isn't terribly interested in spiritual life in a profound way, just in parentheses on that, maybe a year or two ago I stopped into an H&M store, this sort of discount clothing brand, and I saw a sweatshirt that said Contemplation Team, instead of WVU rowing or WVU basketball, the Contemplation Team. And for a second it caught my attention, that's kind of cool. But then I realized, people who contemplate, people who pray, don't need to walk around with a shirt saying that to them. The idea of, so culture's interest in the spiritual life. There are maybe some bones thrown, but I think it's about more than buying the sweatshirt to learn to contemplate. But still, in culture has reintroduced some of the same disciplines that have been part of the Christian tradition. Exercises, fasts, diets, but now for aesthetic reasons. And we see the contradiction even in advertising, where we're told we should be skinny and fit and beautiful on the one hand, but then on the other hand, there are just as many advertisements leading us to overeat, to indulge. And somehow the people on the pizza commercials are able to do both. So it's good to be aware of some of the conflicting dynamics that we're exposed to. The monastic fathers see where I am here. Just number my pages. One of the other aspects that we're perhaps particularly susceptible to in America is this viewing the body like a machine. In the name of productivity and lack of time, our relationship with food becomes unhealthy. We become pathological. After all, we're the country that created fast food, this idea that food is there to fulfill this biological function and nothing more. in other countries, in other cultures, they have a different view. I had a conversation recently with an Italian monk who was read an article about, I guess there's a movie that came out about the founder of McDonald's, and he was intrigued by this, the whole concept of fast food that's such a part of our culture, and that's the complete opposite of the traditional Italian way, where you eat to enjoy each other's company, to extend the conversation, to talk about the ingredients, whereas we could tend to be the opposite and just fuel the machine. The Psalms point out that man in his well-being doesn't understand when we're satiated. There's even one, Psalm 17. Men are obtuse in their abundance is a translation of what literally would be they are closed in their fat. Gluttony, in the biblical tradition, makes us heavy, not only in a physical sense, but also in a figurative sense. It provokes a sort of torpor that extinguishes our vigilance and dulls our intelligence. Even Hemingway commented during his sort of meager years, Hemingway, who was never known for his temperance in certain things, but even he commented that when he was a poor young adult, you know, living the dream, writing, wasn't sure where his next meal was going to come from, there was something that added to his clarity when he wasn't weighed down by overeating. He just made that sort of as an aside comment, but something that's notable. And if Hemingway's not enough for us, Jesus says to be vigilant so that your hearts don't become heavy with drunkenness. Gluttony can provoke an unchecked excitation and take away our inhibitions of speech, gesture, relation. How common it is for someone, of course, to drink too much and do something that they end up regretting. This would fall into that excess that takes away our vigilance, takes away our capacity to discern freely. We lose our self-control. Now, we also know that a certain lowering of inhibitions is a good thing. It can relax us. It can help us to relate more naturally. So we're always talking here about excess that takes us over the limit. Gluttony has been called the door of the passions. What and how we eat determines whether the table for us is a place of communion and love and thanksgiving, or of aggression and competition and self-affirmation. An interesting aspect of gluttony, the interesting way of getting at the question of our relationship with food, comes from not only spiritual theological studies, but even a certain understanding of our human development. Eating, in addition to providing physical sustenance, also has strong affective, emotional, and symbolic connotations. It has to do with our desire, eating. It's the first instinct we think about as a baby, the first instinct that puts us in relationship with the world around us is to suck, to be nourished with our mother's milk. And in this nourishment is much more than just physical sustenance, but there's consolation, there's closeness, there's love. There's that satisfaction of the whole being. Nourishment, love, affective support. Everything is tied up in this act. And so, studies have shown that if there is developmental trauma during the nursing phase, then there can be later fixations or regressions to the infantile oral phase. In terms of those harmful ways that our relationship with food shows up, very common, but serious concerns like bulimia, anorexia, as examples of how affective problems can get translated into problems in our relationship with food. Food could often perhaps be substituted for love, and that jumble of meanings and symbolism of physical sustenance, sense of being loved, sense of pleasure. We know it can be used to mask pain. Or if what I desire seems out of reach, well, food is within my grasp. With the mouth we eat, we speak, we kiss. It's all these spheres of communication, affectivity, and sexuality even, overlap and are symbolically present in the act of eating. So just to point out that it's a complex issue, our relationship with food and how we develop as humans. If you'll forgive me, a quick Seinfeld tangent. I'm unapologetically a big Seinfeld fan, always have been, and a certain scene comes to mind that shows how disordered one's life can become in this sort of ball of emotions and desires, that food and sex and all this. So George, at a certain point, begins to feel the need to eat a pastrami sandwich when he's getting intimate with his significant other. And this becomes a need, a habit for him. So every time he and his significant other start to go in that direction, well, he also needs to eat a pastrami on rye. And then, of course, when she's not around, he happens to be eating a sandwich with others. Well, he eats that pastrami and it awakens something. And then this snowballs and accumulates to where finally he has to turn on the TV as well to unite all of his disordered passions. And so it's a silly scene, but it shows us in a light but also sad way of how our disordered desires, you know, one is connected to another. If we give in to them, if we connect them, they really do deform our relationships with the good things of this world, to the point where he couldn't be with a woman without pastrami, without TV. It's doing a disservice not only to himself, but to each of those good things. So with gluttony, with that excess, the means end up becoming an end, which is so often the case in our sin. Or something that's good that should be a means to something else, we take it as an end, that pleasure that it will produce. Food is no longer a means ordered towards life, towards sharing, towards celebrating, but it becomes a disordered pleasure in and of itself that demands to be satisfied in excess. And all of our appetites need to be ordered in order to be healthy, to help us to flourish, beginning with food. And it's not to be forgotten, just as another footnote, that our excessive buying and wasting of food falls into the category of gluttony as we reflect on our relationship with food and how it can turn into something sinful. So gluttony is clearly something that's not easy to combat. And while it's not something that gets a lot of attention in terms of being called gluttony, when we look at the market for shortcuts, for diets, for pharmaceuticals, we realize that the question of our relationship with food isn't easy. Yet it's here in our relationship with food that we begin to understand also something of our spiritual life, of where we are with that. John Cassian, that monk who translated Evagrius's 8 Evil Thoughts into Latin, Cassian says that we must begin to test our condition as free men and women by the submission of our bodies, because everyone is a slave to that which has conquered him. Citing the second letter of Peter there. Everyone is a slave to that which has conquered him. And so we test, how free are we? When I examine my life, my relationship with food in this case, is there something that's conquered me? Is it my pride that I know where the best steak in town is cooked? Is it a matter of quantity, quality? Or am I free? Can I enjoy these things without being enslaved to them? And in the tradition of the church, and perhaps in our own experience, it rings true that if we can't say no to a little quantity of food, it's awfully difficult to say no to those powerful desires in our hearts that can take the quality of voracious beasts. And one comment on the tradition of fasting, I heard from a friend who is a Roman Catholic monk, and they were having an ecumenical gathering with some Orthodox communities. And there was a representative of an Orthodox, one of the smaller Orthodox communities, not the Russian, but let's say Serbia, a smaller country. And they were talking about the possibility of one day being united, everyone sort of in communion with Rome. And the Orthodox said, well, honestly, I don't see it happening, because you in the West, you don't know how to fast anymore. You've lost that as part of your tradition. And if you don't know how to have something in front of you without devouring it, if we join you as a smaller church, you would just gobble us up. You would make us just like you. You wouldn't preserve our identity, our unique traditions, because you don't understand that logic of fasting. Now, that's incredibly insightful of how fasting connects to much more than just what's on the plate, but also our relationship to others, our ability to not appropriate others into ourselves, even if it's within our power, even if it's on the plate, to say, well, no, it's best to leave that. Now, the monastic fathers gave great importance to the quantity of food one consumes. We can look to the rule of St. Benedict, devotes an entire chapter to it, chapter 39. After the Benedictine presence in this parish, we can give a shout out to Benedict. When these show up in monastic rules, it's not just a mere legalistic regulation, but rather an education of our desire. And this is something it's important for us to do as Christians. Again, to not snuff out our desire, to not think of them as bad things, but to educate our desire. Even looking at that word, educate, ex ducere, to lead out. Someone who educates us, leads us out from where we were into a different state, into a different place. And so we do this with the help of our tradition and these tools, with our desire. We help to lead it out in the right direction. And gluttony, as many sins, is caused by a disordered desire, and therefore can be combated by integrating properly this desire and renouncing harmful excess. Part of this is relearning how to listen to our body, and not only to pleasure, which tends towards excess. Cassian, John Cassian, recommends that one takes food according to the needs of our health and not according to desire. So we're talking here about a distinction between desire and biological need and health. This is a dynamic that needs to be considered both with gluttony and with lust. We think of these natural desires, to understand the difference between a desire that doesn't have to be acted upon and a part of our natural function. In Jewish and Christian tradition, of course, food and prayer have always been connected. We recognize food as a gift of God, and not a violent conquest, not just fuel for the machine. We give thanksgiving for our daily bread. It's a memory of communion, sharing of food that is destined for all, not only the few. And the tool, par excellence, proposed by the Christian tradition, is something we just did a few days ago on Ash Wednesday, that moderate and intelligent fasting that's already inscribed into the rhythm of our liturgical year and our weeks. This fasting doesn't mean disdaining food, nor is it a way of meriting favor. We have to be careful not to become prideful because we can keep to a fast and that makes us puffed up and feel strong. An early desert father said, in fact, in vain is your fasting without charity. It's better to eat meat and drink wine than to devour your brothers. So fasting, when we do it moderately, intelligently, it's a way of disciplining and educating our desire in order to discern that which, other than bread, is truly necessary to live. And again, we have yesterday's gospel echoing, man does not live on bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. When we fast, now and then, when we allow ourselves to feel that pang, not in an unhealthy way, but enough to feel it, fasting that we always do in private, it can lead us to reflect upon what and why we eat. When we feel that desire for food, it draws our attention to our need, to our dependence, to our desires. And we ask, well, what are my deepest desires? Abstaining from food can also lead us to ask about our relationships with others and how food is an instrument of sharing and encounter. Or is it a way to satisfy my own pleasure over and against others? Part of our learning to eat means learning to eat with others. The table is a place where men and women have always developed friendships, developed culture, and they've developed friendships and culture when eating is done more than just as a biological function, but when it's done humanly in a way that builds communion among those present. So at table, we don't only share food that nurtures. It's not just a feeding trough. But we also share words that nurture and sustain the relationships that give sense to our life. So it wouldn't make much sense to continue preserving this life by eating, by keeping our biological function going, without the relationships that give sense to it, that give meaning to it. The human being is the only animal that cooks and that eats along with other members of his species, rather than in competition with them. When we're at our best, we're not in competition with each other. And so we must cultivate this capacity for communion, that difference that allows us to have eating be a moment of encounter. Eating involves our deepest bonds with the earth, with work, with family, with society. We literally consume the world into us and transform it. Of course, Jesus places the Eucharist in the context of a meal. The sign of the new covenant is carried out as a shared meal. Of all the ways Jesus could have left us a memorial, something through which to receive him, something by which to remember him, he leads it to us in the context of a shared meal. So our relationship with food is a fundamental place in learning the art of Christian life. When we move from the logic of consumerism to the logic of communion, our eating and drinking become actions that recognize and express the glory of God. And our relationship with food is always revealing of the relationship we have with ourselves and with others. There must be sobriety in terms of knowing the just measure, temperance in the sense of an intelligent limit, and recognition that food is always something for which we should thank others, and justice that means sharing our food with those that don't have enough. And so this comes from largely early Christian sources. I handed out a list of a collection of a few citations from fathers of the church about gluttony. Again, just for your own reflection, edification, amusement. Again, just wanted to offer a few points of reflections to see how our relationship with food very much is a part of our relationship with God, our relationship with others. And without obsessing about it, it can be helpful to go a little deeper into some of these dynamics. So if anyone has comments, corrections, there's some Chex Mix up here as well.
There's an article in the paper today, just written by a columnist who wrote strikes once a week, and I kind of skimmed it, but basically she was writing about how it's good to fast, and she's glad it's Lent, but it had absolutely no spiritual connection at all. It was just, this is a good thing to do for a body. And so and I thought, that's interesting. And I think I've heard somewhere, it's a well, fasting without prayer is just dying.
Right. But at the same time, I think it's good for us as Christians to also know how to speak about these things in terms that others who don't have the Christian vocabulary could understand. So, you know, anyone who's pointing out positive aspects of some of our traditions, even if it's in a different language, a more anthropological language, I'd say they're most welcome, and we do well to learn from them, to, you know, how do we explain our faith traditions to people that are just coming from different categories. So I really think that's part of our task in today's world, is to also learn how to express the depth of our tradition in a way that's not just Christian jargon that people don't listen to anymore if they're not already kind of part of that. So I'm glad to hear that was in the paper.
Yes.
So everyone is, of course, invited to come back next week when we'll explore what that crafty tempter alluded to at the end of the reading from Lewis, how gluttony can then lead into attacks on chastity. So next week we'll look at lust, you know, not just in its relationship with gluttony, but that is next on the list. So we'll go forward eating and giving thanks artfully and as Christians, and reconvene to look at lust and how it's a deformed relationship with our bodies and with sexuality.
Thank you.
Oh, I just had a question for you. Oh, how would you view gluttony as a percent, I mean as a dominant sin in our society? Do you consider it one of the really most common, most dominant type of things? I mean, given the level of our obesity and overweight and all that, and the health problems, great health problems involved from that, and is it that consciousness among people that it is a sin? You know, that excessive eating and wrong kinds of eating really is sinful.
I don't find that there's a lot of consciousness or willingness to call it a sin in a moral sense. I think there's a great recognition that it's a health problem, but you know, in terms of, I don't have 35 years experience in the confessional like Father Paul Wharton that I mentioned, but very rarely do I hear gluttony confessed as a sin. So I mean, I think there's in terms of a cultural, if we're looking at sin as something that deforms our relationship with the goodness of the world, something that ultimately harms ourselves, something that comes from disordered appetites, then I think we have to admit that gluttony is a big sin in our culture. But in terms of moral culpability, you don't hear that talked about or recognized too much. And even I would hesitate to say that that's one of the major sins, you know. I think it's maybe something that is worth looking at more deeply. I don't want to stand up here and say that, yes, all these people are sinning terribly and they don't even realize it because, you know, they eat a little bit too much. So it's, but no, I guess, yeah, my answer would go back to, I think we have to recognize it as a harmful sin in our society, because of its negative effects on our well-being. And also, as I mentioned, the way it opens the door to other sins. Where, I mean, not only on a college campus, but it's very common in college for, you know, people to drink in excess. And then that leads to all kinds of ruptures of relationships and harm to oneself and harm to others and using others. So yeah, I think there's a lot that falls under that sin of gluttony that's both recognized and not recognized.
Father, I found it interesting that you mentioned that someone who doesn't want to eat a lot, that's a form of gluttony. Can you expound on that? Because I've never heard that where someone, take this away.
Yeah, well, that's part of the reason why I let Lewis talk about that part, because it's something that is really sneaky, perhaps, and I don't know that I could articulate it any better than he did. But maybe not so much somebody that doesn't want to eat a lot, but if they don't want to eat a lot because they don't accept the food's quality, you know, they're too demanding. I think that's a little more where the terms of, it's not so much gluttony through abstinence, but gluttony through being a snob, where
there's actually a new eating disorder I read about that's called orthorexia, and it's people who, you know, are so fearful of eating something, you know, that might be bad for them, you know, if it's not organic and not this and not that, you know, and just they get so worried that then they just don't eat anything, you know, and then so it turns into like an anorexia situation, but they called it orthorexia.
So maybe I would return the question to you or to Augie. Do you buy that? You know, that idea of there being a gluttonous aspect to kind of an overly refined palate in an exaggerated way?
I think if we're thinking of it in terms of my needs must be satisfied, mm-hmm. whether it's eating everything on the table or having it my way, you can kind of look at it like that woman was with her tea and her toast. It had to be just so, because that's how it pleases me, that's what I want. You can see how it overlaps with, I'm putting it in my mouth because it pleases me, and it's what I want.
Yeah, and I think an important aspect there was that this attitude was leading to her crabbiness, which then caused troubles with relationships and bitterness and all that. So it's in the way with which it's done.
It was also like a form of control.
Right.
In the part that you read from the book.
The thing that struck me was how connected gluttony is with a more general self-indulgence. So you might not be able to identify gluttony. I mean, we might not be able to identify gluttony just because we associate it simply with food. But, I mean, seems to me like you could have a gluttony of senses. You could have a gluttony, a desire for, you know, yeah, control or information or some kind of sensory input. And that's all gluttony, but we think about it just in terms of food. But so it's too narrow a conception that we have of that sin, which is more like a massive self-indulgence, no matter what the medium that expresses itself in.
Right, when it becomes that consuming of whatever it is I'm consuming in an unhealthy way.
Right? Anything.
It's no longer a means to sharing, to communion, to growth.
I've seen some connections today in overuse of cell phones and technology leading to depression. Instead of food, it's the technology.
No, I think you're right. I totally agree.
But I mean, I've seen some, you know, that leads to depression.
Well, I've read that there's actually you know, release of serotonin when you swipe the dopamine,
dopamine
when you swipe the phone,
so
then you literally
you
become
response,
addicted.
Yeah. It's as addictive as alcohol and drugs, the dopamine response.
Given this fasting has both really good spiritual benefits as well as physical and health benefits, it seems like we get very little teaching about fasting and very little expectation that we're going to fast in any meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, I don't know, would you comment on that? Should we really look at this a lot more seriously. I mean, Jesus fasted 40 days. I mean, and we have a hard time thinking of just fasting a couple days, you know. A lot of people never tried it.
You know? Right.
And maybe we should really get into that a lot more.
Well, and I think even, as I mentioned, comparing our lack of attention to fasting with other Christian traditions, with the East, the Christian East, fasting carries much more moral weight, where if they don't keep a fast, that's something that's they're going to need to confess that. They feel like they have really gone against the precept of their faith. And perhaps, now I suspect in our culture, even in our sort of ecclesial culture, fasting may be sometimes tagged as, one of those old-fashioned pious ways, but we're free in Jesus. We don't need to worry about that. But so maybe kind of a superficial understanding of the spiritual and human value of fasting that I agree is something that perhaps we should deepen our understanding of, and also learn to articulate it better so it's not taken as just some sort of superficial pious act.
Do you know why? Why did the Catholic Church? Because we had, we fasted on Fridays for many years, many decades or centuries from me. Okay, and then they did away with that as a rule at a time when hedonism was rising tremendously. I mean, it seemed like we were going in the wrong direction with that one. We were just going along with the society. Do you know why that was done away with? Any idea?
I don't know why. I can just say it's still, technically, we're still asked to abstain from meat on Fridays, and if not, then to substitute some other mortification or abstain from something else. Clearly it's not. I grew up eating pepperoni pizza at home on Fridays, and Friday night pizza from a Catholic family, so you're right that it's not adhered to like it was once upon a time, and I don't know the reason, the logic of making that change.
There was also, a long time ago, more Eucharistic fasting, days of the year that were fast days, mm-hmm. like Christmas Eve and other times of the year we had fasts. And as I remember, my dad's birthday was on Christmas Eve, and he couldn't eat. He made him mad. He said, "I'm going back to Baptist."
I think we do have to be very careful with fasting, so it doesn't become a point of pride. And Jesus specifically talks about that in the gospel for a reason. That we need to hear that if we're going to do fasting, if we're going to implement it more. It can't be so we can seem to be fasting, so we can seem to be holy.
I thought the church's thing was wanting us to do more rather than to fast. Mm. Because I was a child growing up, every Friday there was no meat. But they wanted us to do more works of charity, works of mercy, than to do this.
Changing of emphasis.
But the two are not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. Good point. Right. Yeah.
I think people who try to do fasting will also try to frequently do more works of mercy.
Both men.
Yeah. Right.
I'm going to ask you something that people pick for themselves to do, because I like fish. So for me, not eating meat on Fridays is not a big deal. Okay. So getting on Facebook is a bigger deal.
But isn't there also something about this idea that if you get to choose what you fast from, which is good, right? But we get to choose, so in a way it's almost easier than if there's a set of things that are just kind of de rigueur that you must submit to this, that we may gain to extent when we get to choose what fast from, because at least it's tailored to our proclivities. But on the other hand, we lose an obedience. We lose the chance to obey. even something that feels arbitrary.
Yeah,
yeah, well, that's the bonus part. That's the bonus part. But there's this other part that
it goes back to, you know, how do we use our freedom? Is it an opportunity to cut a corner? Like, okay, I don't want to give up meat, so I'll give up something easier. Or, you know, we're taking it seriously as an opportunity for growth, and maybe, okay, well, I'll give up the dopamine hit from Facebook or whatever that may be. So, and that, I think that shows up in lots of different approaches and just living as believers. You know, a question of, well, is it better to have somebody else telling you what to do in order to be holy, or to appeal to your freedom and say, okay, well, here's some suggestions. Now you've got to mature in your faith and make some decisions here.
So is fasting the spiritual opposite of gluttony?
It's, if not the opposite, I'd say, at least traditionally seen as sort of the antidote, as something that does help to maybe order the disordered desires that would lead to gluttony. And at least in my sort of preparations, I didn't come across any more concrete, consistent suggestion other than, you know, fasting in terms of, okay, well, how do I address it if I recognize it as a problem?
So you can use fasting as a way to re-educate a desire of...
Right. And that's, yeah, and fasting and any kind of asceticism is always a means. You know, if that becomes the end, then you're getting into an unhealthy rigor that not leading you closer, not making you more charitable, not making you more just, not making you closer to God. That again becomes a question of pride and my own discipline. So even using fasting as a way to re-educate desires needs to be done thoughtfully as well, to make sure we're doing it for the right reason.
It does seem like very little is asked of us in that respect. I mean, I know growing up, we never ate meat on Friday, and something still my family doesn't, but it was like fish sticks every single Friday. 20 years or whatever. It was just the way it was. I mean, it was really just kind of easy and predictable. And then maybe you'd get it on like Wednesday too. Oh, fish sticks twice in a week, you know. It was like torture, whatever. But so it's, you know, I'm Byzantine Catholic and we have different fasting periods, which I think probably were common in the Roman Catholic Church too, that maybe were dropped with the apostles, like the apostles' fast, the Nativity fast, and the Dormition fast, the Assumption, and of course Easter, Lent beforehand. But it's really beautiful to get kind of the feasting, fasting, you know, dichotomy thought going. Not like feasting is like pigging out, you know, but like a feast is something like with the movie Bad Bets Feast. It's like beautiful and, you know, there's something elaborate and we're giving thanks to God and, you know, kind of the whole Thanksgiving idea too. But, you know, I just think it'd be really beautiful for people to learn to incorporate that more in. You know, you've got your fasting periods, but then you have your special feasting too. Whether it's your Saint's Feast Day, or the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, or something that's important to you and your family, that can be a beautiful way to incorporate, you know, those two things in that go together. You know, with you have your fasting, but you have your feasting too.
Sure.
You know, that's, which isn't taken out.
I think our problem today, though, it's way too much feasting, way too much.
Oh, for sure, yeah, sure.
We are just over the wall.
And it's like a first world problem, too. I mean, remember hearing a story of someone who came over here from, you know, I don't know what country, but not like our country that's overflowing with all this stuff. And,
right.
And he wanted to go, he said something like, well, I'll take you out for some chicken or something. And then he was saying, well, do you want this? Do you want this? Do you want this? And he's like, don't just eat chicken. Like, I mean, he couldn't even conceive of like all these different choices of what kind of chicken you can get, you know. And so, like, we just, you know, the choices are overwhelming. It's just overwhelming, the choices. So, I think that makes it easy to fall into being picky. Oh, I don't want this. Or, oh, I gotta get this. You know. Yeah.
Right. Sometimes I'll be in the grocery store next to like an elderly person in the cereal aisle, and they're just, you know, and I'm always like, there are way too many choices here and there. There should be some thought. That would be enough.
If you're fast enough, you love oatmeal. Then you know you're fast. Well, I like it, but you really like it.
I think when I was a kid, sometimes the Friday thing, even though we could meet, it could become a burden for someone else, because like, as children, if they were going to someone else's house, they had to fix something special if there's one Catholic kid. So that, you know, that was kind of the negative aspect of that. Find something else to give up that wasn't a burden for someone else,
right,
or inconvenience for someone else.
See, we were always taught that you just accepted the charity. I mean, and of course, you know, you're like, yes, hot dogs, you know, not fish sticks. It's no big deal for you. But, you know.
We had to go to confession if we ate hot dogs.
That's true.
I was just thinking about how our culture over my lifetime has changed as far as the eating as a family. I know my dad often was late getting home, but my mother and my brothers would have dinner together at the dining room table, and we all ate the same thing. Today, when I visit my children and grandchildren, this wants this, and this wants this, and this wants this, and they may not even all eat at the same time. And so I think we need to be aware of these patterns in society, and we need to be very charitable to all that. I haven't quite worked out in my own being yet. But I do think eating out and bringing in food has changed some of that communion. I didn't even think about it as communion when I was growing up, but looking back, there was a togetherness that is a little different today.
Well, I certainly haven't integrated in my life either. Just reveal one of the secrets of living in a rectory. You know, there are three of us who live here, and some nights we'll have dinner pretty much at the same time, but I'll make kind of what I want to make, Father Kumar will make what he wants to make, Father Wall will make what he, and we're all kind of there around, but it's not that intentional moment of communion that it could be. And you know, the more we start to pay attention to these things, kind of have to call myself out on that and go, oh, wait a second, why don't we make it a more communal moment of sharing and real conversation?
And I think we have so much information today, and we're all fairly sophisticated people, that instead of the church dictating these things to us, we can develop our own fasting and our own family traditions around our faith. And we just have to do it.
Right.
And not expect to be told to do it. And each of us will have our own little nuances. But we have the information, so we should just do it. And it's easy to talk about the way it used to be and why it isn't that way anymore and where the church failed and all those things. As all those things can be considered, but now we just have to take our step. And if we want to fast, you know, and so forth and so on. It's very challenging. It's maybe was easier 60, 70, 100 years ago when we were just told what to do, and perhaps in being told what to do, some of the spirituality was lost on some people. You know, it just became an obligation. But now we're more enlightened, hopefully, and we have a great deal of information. So now we can just, like the sweatshirt said, just do it.
I think I've learned a lot tonight, and hearing the room is tradition. I never knew why we didn't have to, we couldn't eat growing up. Did any of you know that? Why we didn't have to do that? But really, what I think fasting is the things that take us away from God. whether it be your computer, right, or internet, or whatever those things are, that take us away from having that constant communion with the Lord, is, and if we fast away from those things, we stay connected with God in a more meaningful way. That's what I got tonight. I mean, just listening to everybody, and you know, we have all these traditions, and I think a lot of us didn't really know what truly fasting was. Like, I didn't know what gluttony was. You know, I mean, I don't know. Just, I learned a lot. Thank you, Father. Thank you, Father.
Oh, thank you. This is wonderful. Thank you for your input. So I was hoping to sort of provoke a response and some reflection with these concepts and aspects of our faith, that maybe we use these words or we know they're there, but then to really just stop and take a little time and go deeper, and then we can all learn from each other and from those voices that came before us. So I also want to respect your time, and it's almost 8:30, so I'll formally close if people want to stay and chat. Of course, I'm around, but we'll stop here and pick up with lust in a week.